The crew lists and official logs of the British Mercantile Marine first came to my attention in 1949, when I was a humble shipping man working in the City of London. Every spare moment at that time I spent undertaking research, either on the statutory registers of merchant ships, the bills of entry for London and several outports, the collected aboard letter books of HM Customs and Excise, and not least the crew agreements. These last, for those of you that are not familiar with them, are a vast accumulation from which we may determine the manning and the deployment and the ownership of each and every merchant ship sailing under the British flag, and that includes, of course, the plantations, the colonies of the dependencies and the dominions, from 1835 onwards, following an Act of Parliament obtained in that year, which archive. From this archive, we can analyse virtually every voyage made by a British merchant ship, be they so large or small. Indeed, many of the crew agreements you will find are for vessels that were too small even to be registered. There are several crew agreements to be found, lots of crew agreements to be found, for vessels of under 15 tons. Now, in the vast scale of things, these vessels may not seem very important. But anyone actually working on the local level who wants to look at sources of supply of things brought by sea or outputs of local commodities that are sent by sea, the cumulative voyages of these tiny vessels can, of course, be significant. We have for these vessels details of every member of every crew, whose year and place and birth is given, the capacity in which he served, his wages, any disciplinary infraction that he may have sustained against the mate, or the master, or any other of the crew. His discharge date is recorded. We know quite a lot about some of the ills to which men were then heir, especially, of course, seafarers. There is much, too, about the owners of ships, their managers, the actual passages made by the vessels, and the ports at which they called. The uniqueness of this archive is its inclusivity. For no other segment of the working population of Britain do we have a comparable corpus of information concerning ships, their masters, their crews, and their voyages. And I emphasize the crews because, of course, it goes without saying that this is the only part of the working population of Britain for whom we have comparable material. Now, when I first inspected these records, I was relatively young. I possessed no academic training in 1949. But it didn't take much insight in my part to recognize that this was an archive of great and intrinsic worth that had been neglected by scholars, just as the pre-existing muster rolls of ships had been. Looking at the crew agreements in 1949 for me was a simple matter, since these voluminous records were housed in the Mint Building, Tower Hill, and it was easy for me to sneak out from the office in the lunch hour, and sometimes at other times, and spend half an hour or so looking at what I wanted. However, I little thought that the conveniences that I had briefly enjoyed could be so abruptly terminated. Now, what was to happen was the Festival of Britain, an event now as remote for many as the more celebrated exhibition of 1851. Some of the older of my audience may have been in London at the time and may remember the Dome of Discovery, the Skylon, and the old shot tower, sadly demolished. But what, I hear you cry, has the Festival of Britain to do with crew agreements and official logs? Well, it was part of the celebrations that there was to be an exhibition at the Mint. As a consequence, the entire archive was moved to what the officials of the Public Record Office called limbo. That is to say, to haze in Middlesex. A limbo for me indeed. Lacking a car, working on Saturdays, ships didn't wait for maritime historians any more than anybody else. Limbo was remote for me as, dare I say it, St. John's, Newfoundland. Visits to Hayes became increasingly tedious and difficult. However, Once the celebrations of 1951 were over, I entertained an apparently unreasonable expectation that the records would be returned from whence they had come. Sadly, this was not to be. They remained at Hayes in large hangar-like buildings where much administrative paperwork goes through the process of weeding. That is, decisions previously made about what documents in the public domain are actually carried out by men of somewhat advanced years. Can I interpolate at this point and paint a picture of what the actual process of weeding, as distinct from whiting, is? Long tables in these vast buildings and bundles of documents. To this, I began A, to wonder about weeding, and B, to wonder about the records. To this end, I corresponded with those in whose empires these records resided, officials of the Registrar General of Shipping and Seamen and the Public Record Office. Not least, I contacted the National Maritime Museum. None of these august bodies seemed to treat my inquiries with either interest or enthusiasm. In short, I was, as always, a bloody nuisance. Rumours began to reach me in the 1960s that the weeding process might be applied to these precious records. Well, you may wonder why. Well, their quantity and bulk is formidable. There's a certain building not 1,000 miles from here where you can demonstrate just how formidable the volume of the records is. Take that part of the archive then most under threat, the crew agreements for the period 1862 to 1913. The records for this period extend to 29,598 boxes, a 15,000-foot run of records. And this is quite a lot of records. Now, Memorial has since taken all the crew agreements from 1913 and is in process of receiving them up to 1975. I don't know what the total shelf requirement now is, but my God, it's a lot of shelving. Now, when it became generally known that there was being posed a threat to the crew agreement, some of us did what is always done in Britain on such an occasion. We formed a committee. By this time, I had undergone something of a transformation myself from being something in the city to being equal, humble something academic. This followed an extensive process of de-schooling at the London School of Economics. This didn't change me much, but it had a perceptible change in the manner in which my concern about the records was received. Suddenly, I became to those in the Public Record Office and in the general domain of archives a much bigger bloody nuisance. Our committee did, of course, what all committees do on such occasions, that is, write a letter to the Times. We attracted support even from maritime historians, most of whom had never realised that crew agreements existed. Most maritime historians, of course, had barely begun to think that vessels were actually manned, and that those that manned them might be as nearly as interesting as the vessels upon which they served. Our campaign had a valuable educative function, and in fact spawned another committee set up under the aegis of the Institute of Historical Research, University of London. Gradually we chipped away at PRO obduracy. They conceded that they might despairingly keep, quote, samples. We asked what a sample might be. They said airily, oh, say 5%. We said, why 5% rather than 4.5% or 6.5% or 9.75%? Having conceded the sample, my colleague Roderick Flood and I decided to carry out a statistical survey to determine what the sample might fairly be. When we had completed our survey, we made our recommendations. And we had enormous help from the British Records Association, thanks to good people like Will Smith, later the London Record Office, and others who weighed in with the views of the country the county, the county, the borough, and the city archivist. Many wanted to see the records of ports of registry that lay within their domain preserved. During the negotiations, I became even more aware of the problems that arise from weeding that I had than I had had on my brief visits to Limburg. And this is a very important matter. It doesn't just apply to this record, it applies to all records in the public domain, wherever they may be. And it's an important point. One early concession by the PRO was that they and the National Maritime Museum would agree to preserve the crew agreements for certain, quote, important, or, quote, interesting, or, quote, historical, unquote, vessels. Now, this raises any number of historiographical problems that I can't engage here, but it is worthwhile asking the question, important, interesting, historical to whom? There was no recognition that there might be changes in what historians found interesting or important, or even what might be properly regarded as history. Indeed, come to think of it, to some people, the Festival of Britain that had spawned this activity is history. To others, I suppose, it is barely a life wink away. Thus it was proposed to destroy, at the time, 20th century crew agreements. And this was thought by some to be acceptable. However, after many meetings, it was decided that the PRO and National Maritime Museum would keep appropriate samples, that the record offices through Britain would have the right to keep those crew agreements that were relevant to their offices, and the rest should be destroyed. The rest of the story you know. Professor Keith Matthews of Memorial carried out a superb rescue mission which assured the preservation of the remaining 70% of the archive not raided by PRO, National Maritime Museum and British Record Offices. And in this, of course, the wholehearted support of the administrators of Memorial University deserved particular commendation. When it was that the Maritime History Group was formed at Memorial, I think in about 1971, an application was made to the then Canada Council for financial support in a great research programme to be called the Atlantic Canada Shipping Project.